Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is a legendary American writer, Hubert Selby Jr. From the time he published Last Exit to Brooklyn to his most recent book, Waiting Period, a new novel published by Marion Boyers, available in America but published in England, his work has been a nonstop aggression, in a sense, against the American way, when we speak of that way too complacently. The voice is always the voice of the undertrodden, the powerless, the person taking power in his mind. It's an absolutely distinctive voice. Unlike most American writers known for their voices, there is no real pleasure. Ain't no pleasure in it. In the voices of Selby, when we talk about voice, we usually start talking about Huckleberry Finn, and we talk about all those funny locutions. But from the very start, your voice is interested in a certain kind of antagonism and a certain kind of jangling, fierce, alarm clock-like quality. And why is that? And how did you know that from the beginning?
How I knew from the beginning... It's difficult to explain because, see, I started writing because I wanted to do something before I died. And I had been given up for dead four times. It was an ongoing thing. I spent years in the hospital after the Second War. And I had a series of experiences that first led me to writing because I knew that someday I was going to die. And it wouldn't be like had been happening. They tell me I'm going to die and somehow I survive. But I would die. And just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. Number two, I would want to live my life over again. And then I would die. And it was a kind of experience that is far more real than any experience we have. This level of consciousness. I realized today that it was a spiritual experience, but I had no idea what was happening at the time. But the remarkable thing is I listened to it and I followed it. And then a series of events or more experiences, and I started to understand how I need to write. That I asked myself, now, why do I have this story in my head? And the answer was there instantly, because that's the one you're going to write. But these things were so profound at the time. And I realized that what I had to do as an artist was to understand this story that has already been given to me. Find the very nucleus of the story, the psychodynamic, the moral imperative, and from that create a work of art. I also knew that I was a frustrated teacher and a frustrated preacher, and I had to do everything I possibly could to keep that out of the work, that I had no right to impose myself between the people created on the page and the reader. So actually, I didn't know it, but what I started doing was try to get free of the human ego, which is so necessary to create a work of art, but absolutely impossible for the artist to live with. And I knew that I had to be honest, and I had to be true to these people. I didn't have a right to interfere with their lives, that they have to live their life. And I have to honor that. And I can't have them live happily ever after when everything they do is leading to destruction, no matter how much that bothers me and upsets me. So I had to allow them to live their life, and as I'm creating this life and allowing it to live, it decides the structure and form of the story. And then I just try and be true to it, which means I have to find a way to reflect that psychodynamic. I have to find a vocabulary for these people that reveals them without that intrusive narrator. I also knew that if I wrote the way I was being directed to write, that I would look like a barbarian, a primitive. And if I had to, if I didn't succeed perfectly, I'd look like an idiot. But, you know, I had no choice. Anyway, that's where it all started, and I had to find the means, as I say, to be loyal to these people, to be true to the nature of their lives rather than imposing my concept of how they should live.
Now, a lot of the time when you've spoken about starting to write, you talk about teaching yourself to write, but my sense is that there were other writers around, that they were writers that you hung out with and knew when you were young. Who were they, and how did you know them?
Well, the first, of course, was Gil Sorrentino. We come from the same neighborhood. We went to the same elementary school, and later on went to the jazz clubs together, hung out in the same pool room, that sort of thing. And he is, you know, my mentor, really, because he would read everything I wrote. And sometimes it seems to me, anyway, that we would spend an hour trying to deal with, why did you use that word instead of this word? And so by the time I finished Last Exit, which took 6 years, I knew why every comma was there. I was, you know, in retrospect, I knew exactly why that had to be there. You know, it was, and of course, then we were hanging out with Roy, Miri Baraka, and all the poets in the late 50s and early 60s in New York, and the painters, the musicians. The greatest time in all of history, as far as I know, to be alive. It was just fantastic. Joel Oppenheimer was a regular.
You know, I'm a young guy, or was, picking up Last Exit to Brooklyn. It's a first book, and it's got slashes instead of apostrophes, and it doesn't have colons, and it spells some things wrong consistently. And I wondered about the vocabulary, because there's never been any effort to develop outside the framework of that kind of grammar, that kind of run-on sentence, that kind of vocabulary. It's there from the beginning, and it's as if all the other books are explorations, further explorations in the space of that lexicon.
Well, I write by ear, among other ways. And you can't separate music from life. And my typography, for instance, is musical notation. And I see, what I want to do is put the reader through an emotional experience. Because what else is there? That's the important thing. Now, what I have to do then is experience these emotions I'm trying to project. And music is a very inherent part of that to help somebody experience these things. So I have to create this musical notation, because everybody has their own rhythm, and I have to make that evident in their own vocabulary, and their vocabulary is a part of that rhythm. If I perceive through my ears a certain world, my vocabulary will reflect that in how many syllables I usually use in a word, how I adjust the rhythm and beat of a line, that sort of thing. And also, it's visual. All these have to come together to produce this emotional experience. And visually, I find things like quotation marks obtrusive, ridiculous, and totally unnecessary. The apostrophe actually is something else, because The typewriter I had was a portable typewriter. Now, the apostrophe on these old typewriters is uppercase on the number eight.
Eight, that's right.
And it takes 20 pounds of pressure
to try
and push that thing, whereas the slash is lowercase question mark.
Uh-huh.
So the slash is just so much easier than the apostrophe. And I don't like apostrophes anyway. For instance, why do I need an apostrophe for words like don't, didn't, won't? It just does not make sense. Plus, it interferes with what I'm trying to do. So they go, boom, 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 boom.
Now, were you writing quickly, as that begins to suggest that you're...
I wrote a couple of things. Tralala, which is about 20 pages long, a part of Last Exit, took me 2.5 years. So I wouldn't consider that very rapid. But what I finally came to realize was that you don't sit down and learn anything all at once. And you have to remember, I never went to school. I never read much except for the few years before I started writing. And I certainly never tried writing. So I know nothing about this. So I'm really trying to get it all at one time, and you can't. In other words, I'll write a little story or an anecdote, and maybe what I'm learning to develop here without realizing it is my ability to write narrative. Maybe the next time it's structure. Some other time might be dialogue. So what I was doing was looking for the story. And after 2.5 years... I'd found the story, but I still didn't understand it. Then I finally realized that in this story, what it was that I had to learn to do was reflect the psychodynamics of an individual through the rhythm and tension and beat of a prose line. And now once I realized that, then the story just wrote as fast as I could type it.
Because these do have the feeling of white heat behind them. Now, many people tell me that white heat is achieved through slow and disintegrating work. But I still think that the drafts are written with a certain kind of intensity and speed. It's the rewriting that that takes the time, I think.
Well, I don't know. In a case, it depends. Now, where I'm at. And Tralala, as I say, was 2.5 years for 20 pages. Now, later on, when I had individually learned the various aspects of my craft and then learned how to coordinate it, then it would, boom, much faster. Requiem, which was my fourth book, took 6 weeks, including the rewriting.
Phew!
So... But by that time, it was ingrained in me. I understood what I had to do, and I had acquired the skills that made it possible for me to do it. So then it did go much longer. But the other thing, for instance now, The Queen is Dead. There's the last, I don't know, 2 pages or something like that. Georgie's dying on a subway. That took me months. I'd come home from work. I'd get one word.
What were you working at the time? Where were you working?
In an insurance agency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the next night I'd get one more word. Now, it all reads like boom, 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 boom. But it came out one word at a time.
Well, what's interesting to me about The Queen is Dead and about the book in general, you talk to people from Brooklyn, and of course... They say immediately, who've read the book, I didn't know there were so many transvestites in Brooklyn. And one of the extraordinary things of the book is that it says with a fierce command, this is Brooklyn, or this is a state of the soul called Brooklyn. But it's no one else's Brooklyn, or...
Yeah, who wants to lay claim to that, right?
Yeah, right. And but you see, what's extraordinary is there, in ways that don't appear in the other books, Georgette is extremely well observed. There's a lot of detail. You decry and deny that you do detailing and description, but you do an enormous amount with her. It's as if you've seen this man, woman, and whatever she was so interesting to you that you decided to capture it. You watch it happen on the page, mm-hmm. getting the inflections of the voice, getting the stance, getting the way she baits men, and the way girl boys who are better than her, better baiters, mm-hmm. bait, because she's relatively innocent when it comes to that, but mm-hmm. Harry comes up against a pro by the end of the book, and she destroys him. Mm-hmm. But what was that world like, and how was it that you were seeing it?
Well, I was seeing it because when I went to sea at the end, towards the latter part of the war, a friend of mine went to prison, and I came out of the hospital. We kind of hooked up, and I was hanging out down there by the Army base in Brooklyn, and that's where these people, I don't know anybody lived there except Georgie. Georgie lived right in that neighborhood, and you can imagine what it must have been like for her. But, see, I loved Georgie very much. I didn't understand any of this at the time. But the thing that attracted me to Georgie, and of course I'm operating in ignorance at the moment, was alienation. I have always felt alienated, never felt a part of anything. Now, Georgie must have felt alienated. Here's this teenager, he's about 6'2", 110 pounds, with stardust on his eyelids, as queer as a $3 bill, pads in his T-shirt, and the waterfront in Brooklyn. That's alienation. So I had that point of identification. So I knew, although not accepted within my conscious mind yet, how this poor sucker suffered, because I've been suffering like that all my life. And Georgie was responsible for me writing that book. I wrote the first part of The Queen is Dead from the beginning to where he gets stabbed in the leg and they take him home.
Outside the coffee shop.
Yeah. About a year and a half after that, I ran into somebody from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the street, literally in the street, dead of an OD. And that really, really disturbed me, because he may have still been in his teens when he died. And as I say, I had this very deep affection and identification. And so it really disturbed me, so I knew that I couldn't let Georgie just die like that. I had to allow him his full life. So I went back to finish his story, and as a result, the book came from that.
Now, the book was published in 1964. And there had been sections that had been appearing since around 1957. Mm-hmm. What were some of the literary magazines that were around at the time that you were involved
with?
Well,
let's see. Provincetown Review had... The editor went to jail for publishing Tralala.
Really?
Yeah. And there was the Black Mountain Review. They published the first part of Queen is Dead. Love's Labor's Lost, that's what it was called. And we put out Neon, and then Roy Amiri Baraka was putting out Eugen, and he and Diane DePrimo were putting out The Floating Bear. I can't remember the names of all of them, but we were very busy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a wonderful time. Very, very busy.
There was Caterpillar, I think, and all sorts of literary magazines flowing up everywhere. And still at that time, the Paris Review still had that funny above-ground, underground status. And it was a community as well of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And do I have it right? Was Gil Sorrentino working at Grove Press at the time?
Yes, he was working at Grove when the book was published, I don't know how long he worked at Grove, a couple of years maybe.
Mm. Did he bring it there? Is that how it got there?
No. Somebody knew some editors at one of the large publishing houses and took my last exit, the manuscript, up there. And so I had lunch with them one day. Seymour Krim, that's who it was.
Oh, yeah.
Lovely Seymour.
Shake it for the world.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I had lunch with these people, and they said, well, we'd like you to sign a contract and write a regular novel, which we'll publish, and then we'll publish this.
Oh, they used to try and fool everyone with that trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And said, you know, as you know, nobody will buy this book. It's, you know, it won't sell and all that kind of thing. So I was down at the Cedar Street Bar that night. I didn't know what the heck to do. I didn't feel comfortable with what they were offering. And I was talking to Roy Amiri about it. And he said, well, why don't you get an agent? I said, well, I don't even get an agent. He said, try Sterling Law. That's Jack's agent, Jack Kerouac. So I did, and a couple of days later, he called me. He says, I read your book. I think we can make money together. And that's how it got to Barney at Grove.
Now this, and I'm talking to Hubert Selby Jr., and we're talking about the first book, Last Exit to Brooklyn, because it was a huge and dramatic enunciation of a talent. And, you know, I don't think there are many books about which you say no one had ever seen anything like it before.
Mm-hmm.
Why had it been, you know what I think? It was this weird combination of the proletarian novel. No one in the avant-garde had really figured out how to write one. And they were Marxists or Marxist-leaning, and so this was an open question at the time. Second, with The Sun Also Rises, Hemingway had brought in the subject of impotence, physical mm-hmm. impotence, and this book brought the subject of impotence to the working class in a certain way. And weirdly, I think, The Sun Also Rises had given a mystique to impotence, that impotence was a new form of sexuality almost, because it was such an unusual confession for a novel. And then third, to bring this question of impotence to the world of transvestites and homosexuals and drug addicts, where it really lives, I mean, where mm-hmm. it's a really crazy subject. And then have the real subject be love and lovelessness with its expression in impotence. This really created a kind of avant-garde with a lot of dirt in it, but a true heart beating in it as mm-hmm. well. And I think that there was no way to escape this novel, whoever you were, as long as you read it. And I think with the case of Hubert Selby Jr., my guest, the issue has always been that people know that they won't be able to escape, and so to some extent they resist. There's a huge resistance against mm-hmm. the material. Now I know, as it happens, that my first response to Last Exit to Brooklyn was your mother's. I said, oh, these poor people.
Oh, that's so cool.
When I read that you said that, that she had said that to you, I thought, oh, my God, how does he know them? Oh, these poor people. Now, I know what the literary press's response was like, and it was the perfect time for that kind of explosive response. But what was the response of the poor people that you were writing about?
I'd have no way of knowing, because they don't read books. They don't read about books either. So I have no idea. None whatsoever. A couple of people from the neighborhood read it, or said they did, and they all had this, exactly the same comment. This ain't the way it was. Yeah.
Now, in the course of putting together a book that was in certain ways not the way it was, and then in other more essential ways exactly the way it was,
mm-hmm.
you developed an idea of what art does when it takes hold of material and reshapes it and rearranges it. What were the ideas about art at that time?
Well, I don't think I defined them as ideas about art at the time. I think it stayed completely within the sphere of writing. As I said before, what I had to do as a writer, I had to understand that story and from it create a work of art. That's why people in the neighborhood didn't recognize the story.
But what goes into that transformation, even from today's perspective?
Well, first of all, again, the primary thing is for me to not indulge my ego, not to impress upon the reader what I think of this, what I think is the answer to this, none of those things, not to give you an out. There is no relief in those first four books. There's no relief, none whatsoever. You have to find your own. I'm not going to tell you how to live. I'm not going to tell you how to accept what's in these books, how to resist it or anything else. So the basic ingredient for me is always to consciously do what I can, not to indulge my ego. That is not art. I used to have that fight with the so-called beatniks all the time. I did it, therefore it's great. I blew on my horn, toot, 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 toot. I put some paint on a canvas, some words on a... No, that's not what it is. There's a discipline, there's an art, there's a form, there's all manner of things that are involved in a work of art. The basic thing, of course, is honesty. Reverence.
I'm talking to Hubert Selby, Jr. This week we've been talking about his first novel, and we're going to talk about the rest of them next week. You can read a section of Hugh Selby, Jr.'s most recent novel, Waiting Period, published by Marion Boyers, on the KCRW website at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week with Hugh Selby on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.